Fascinating discussion with Eldon Taylor here, author of Mind Programming, From Persuasion and Brainwashing to Self-Help and Practical Metaphysics. We'll be back with Eldon and much more on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon, right before the top of the hour break, we were talking about mind programming, and you were mentioning something about national security. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, you'd made the point that we're molded every day and in every way. And what I wanted to say is, even in our definitions, if you think about it, the nature of the dialogue that we have today, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, has changed dramatically. And as it's changed, it's been a matter of the definitions. So here was it last week, the national security people released what they called the Domestic Extremism Dictionary. And I'm sure you heard all about this, George. I'm sure you probably had lots of phone calls. But for all intent and purposes, this dictionary targeted returning vets as potentially a domestic security problem. It also targeted pro-lifers. In fact, it appeared to be written as though it were aimed at targeting many conservative values. Now, I don't want to take a political side on this, but I just want to point this out. Let's assume that you're on the fence. Let's assume that, you know, you're thinking about joining the NRA, but the NRA is named as an extremist potential, a national security risk. What happens is you make a decision that I don't want anything to do with that. I'm going to step over here. Now, you don't even stop to think why these definitions were created, whether they're correct or they're incorrect. You just accept the fact that, well, I don't want to be labeled that way.
Okay.
And you change your position. And if you think about that, the power of those labels, they're actually used by everyone every day. And for example, we have...
That's how you character assassinate someone.
Well, it is, absolutely. It goes even deeper than that. We have a conflict in Congress today, and it's about secret ballots and unions. On one side, we have the Employee Free Choice Act. Okay?
All right.
All right, now that sounds like free choice, like I get to make my decision, you know, all by myself, the privacy of my mind, not under any pressure, et cetera, right? But that's not what that is. That is no more secret ballot. And it versus the other side, Save Our Secret Ballot Act. You see? So in these labels, the entire matter becomes confused, to say the least. So, and every day, those labels are placed on us, and we place those labels on other people, and, you know, we begin to assume that, well, the label has to be correct, and we fall into the politically correct way of doing things, and we never stop to question any of it. Now, hopefully, all of it is marching us to where we want to be. It's marching us to a more civil society. Although, as we talked earlier, you know, when you desensitize an individual's threshold of arousal, these public executions, to the amount of murder and mayhem that we see in the news, etc. Indeed, this is worth pointing out. The average 18-year-old today has seen 200,000 hours of television and over 30,000 murders.
And these video games as well.
And that's, well, hey, they're practice killers. There's no other way to put it. You know, you take a couple of people that haven't shot a gun much, you put them on a knoll outside a school in Columbine, and let them start turning loose firearms, and they never miss.
But why some, Eldon?
Why? Because they've been doing it in arcades.
Now, but let me ask you this. When we were kids, you and me were almost about the same age.
Okay.
We would run around and play cowboys and Indians. Remember?
Absolutely.
We'd have cap guns. We'd point them at our friends. I never went on to shoot anybody.
No. And neither did I.
So why does it affect others and not others?
What was the difference in our civilities? You know, when we were kids, you could have a fist fight. And when you were done, you could shake hands with whoever you had that fist fight with and go on and be friends.
Except the bully.
Well, except the bully.
The bully.
Okay? But today, we have made it so, what we have done is, we're all familiar with the minister. I'm not going to use anybody's name, but we're all familiar with the minister that tells you sex is the greatest evil in the world. You'll go to hell for it, et cetera, that then runs out and has sex
and does
with
what
prostitutes,
he does,
et cetera. We all understand that the repression of those drives, the repression of that material, can actually attract us to that. We have a large part of that going on in our culture right now. We're repressing every physical outlet that a young person might have. And more these young people aren't participating in the physical activities. They're in front of computers. They're in front of their handheld computer games, their Nintendos, and all that other. Or they're in an arcade, or they're on their telephones, and they're messaging each other. You don't see young people doing what we did as kids. But in addition to that, I didn't see 30,000 murders on television. Neither did you.
Nope.
So my values with respect to life were a little different. You know, when you take young people today, it's not uncommon to sit down maybe a 10 or a 12-year-old and ask him how many pets they have and have them tell you, well, I have two. There's my dog, you know, Fido at home, and then I have a cat in my RuneScape game named Jesse. In other words, this 10 or 12-year-old has two pets. He doesn't make any distinction between the fact that one isn't really living.
Yeah, one's
it's
a cyber cat. Yeah.
You know, and the other one is living. There is a desensitization, a divorcing, literally, of the values of life.
Here's an analogy I use. Listen to this. You'll love this.
Good.
Former NFL football player retires. Goes into sales for a company. He's 6'5". He's doing very well, very successful, except with one company. He has to sell one guy who's the buyer of this business, and the guy's 5'5". Every time he walked into his office, he would never get the sale. The guy was always polite to him, but he would never buy, and it just rocked this guy. He couldn't understand it. So one day he was, you know, out to dinner with his buddy, and he said, what am I doing wrong? And his friends asked him questions about the guy. And he said, well, he's a nice guy, but, you know, he's running this business. And, you know, he's 5'5". He said, wait a minute, you're 6'5". You walk into his office and you intimidate him. So this is what you're going to do. So the next day he had an appointment. He walks into the guy's office. He's got his briefcase, which it's open, but he's holding it. All right. The guy didn't know it was open. He fakes a fall, and he falls on the floor. The briefcase opens. All the guy's sales papers go scattering all over this guy's office, and he just lies there on the floor. The little guy gets up from behind his desk, helps this 6'5" football player up, dusts him off, puts his papers in his briefcase for him. They sit down and talk. He walks out with sale.
Yep.
And he always had sales after that with the guy.
Yep.
He made him comfortable.
Absolutely right. It's a marvelous story to illustrate. Had our 6'5" guy rolled in on a wheelchair, would have had the same effect.
Would have had the same effect. Would have got the sale.
That's right. You know, and the people that do that kind of thing, the salesmen, the marketers, they know how those compliance principles work. And that's one of them, and they will apply it. You know, we have this need for self-identification, self-representation, and, you know, everybody's heard of the Caesar complex, the short person's complex, and not Caesar.
Napoleon.
Napoleon, thank you. And your example is a good one. You've got a leader. The leader sees himself as being in control, being in charge, and in comes this guy 6'5", and that's intimidating to anyone. I mean, so that's a very good one.
Years ago, there was a television group. I'm not going to mention its proper name. I started in the infancy of TV. I mean, way back in the 60s. And this executive, and this company was notorious. But this CEO would sit in one of those barber chairs where you could pump up and you'd go up. So people would come and sit in his office, and they'd in his chair, the chair you would sit in, Eldon, would be intentionally small. So you'd sit there and your knees would be together and you'd be like down low, be almost eye level with his desk. And before you came in, he'd pump his chair up and he'd be looking down on you. And he just intimidated people. They hated the guy. Why would he do that?
Power. Power. That's all about power.
Why does he get the power with respect?
Books written on that, like The Territorial Imperative. There was a book by James Drott called The Secret for a long time. It was kind of the underground manual that people in business employed. And it included the tactic, just like you're describing. It included the tactic of where you take over the table. You just kind of spread your material around. Because what that does is it tends to intimidate the other person. If what you're seeking to do is intimidate the other person, that's a great means. If you're insecure with your authority, you're probably going to do something like that. If you have a subordinate that threatens you because they're smarter than you, or you know, you're apt to do that. Lots of those kinds of things used to go on, but they all led to what we came to know as the Peter Principle, too.
A good
leader doesn't do that, you know. A good leader like a Jack Welch or a Lee Iacocca, they don't need to pump up any chairs.
That's right.
And they don't need you to get down on your knees and fake a fall.
That's true.
So, but those are people that have also taken the time to do what we're talking about, to get to that place where they really know who they are. They've really examined what their thoughts are and what their limitations are and what the alternatives are. These are what we call today authentic people, and there aren't too many of them.
Mind control, mind programming, beyond, let's say, business, is being done on a regular basis on populations. Here's, I think, a perfect example, whether you agree with me or not in this one. I said weeks ago that this swine flu situation was not going to be a pandemic. It was hype. And, you know, I stuck my neck out, and I'm going to say I was right.
No, and I think you are right. And what's more, I'll add some paranoia to it for you, George. When those things happen, what goes through my mind is, if they want me to look this direction, what is it they're doing over here that I'm not looking at? You know,
precisely.
You're going to show me the left hand. What do you got in the right hand?
Yeah.
you know, when this whole thing broke out, I have a very good friend that is the equivalent to what would be our Surgeon General in Mexico, or past Surgeon General, Agustin Diaz-Lopez. And from his BlackBerry, he notified me of what was happening in Mexico. And if you follow this at all, you know that, well, one day you have 125 deaths, and the next day, you know, if you turned your back, 2 days later, there are 12 deaths.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what happened to all the others in between,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
What I saw in the news cycle was quite different than what I was getting from Diaz-Lopez's BlackBerry. You know, I said to my wife, you know, I don't know what's going on here, but this is not a straight-up kosher There's something else behind the scenes on this one. I think you called it dead on, but I'll come back and say to you then, why? Because that's what disturbs me. Why? I mean, why would we do this? Why would we alarm everyone?
What's the next step?
Yeah. See, there's a huge impact on the economy there.
See, if it's mind control, if it's brainwashing, there's a bigger plan, isn't there?
Yep, that would be the scheme, you know, again, we get people to march in cadence for two reasons, their appetite and their fear. And
but what about the boy who cried wolf syndrome? What happens there?
Well, see, I don't think you can have a situation with this particular matter that is going to be a boy cried wolf. I think what we're going to probably see is a lot of conversation about you know, the virus is going to lay down for the summer. That's not unlike the pandemic of 1929, I guess it was. 1918. Okay, thank you very much.
Yep.
It laid down for the summer, and then it came back winter with a virulence that killed millions of people. Do you have that number available also?
Well, sir? Worldwide, millions is pretty, that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. So I think that's what we're going to hear. And then will we have a new flu next year? Well, we always have new flus. And will the flu turn out to be a pandemic of the kind that takes lives? I remember the last swine flu. I'm old enough to remember that one. They rushed out all the inoculations and the inoculation itself.
And we didn't have the kind of media we have today.
No, we don't. That was in the 70s.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, again, that wasn't the flu itself didn't hurt people like the cure did.
Yeah.
So, I look at something like that, and I think you're 100% right. The question for me, though, is what is the plan? Why is that going on? What is to be gained out of this crisis? What additional control? I think.
And it's the same as weapons of mass destruction.
It is. It exactly. That's exactly what I had in my mind. You know, the Patriot Act. Arguably, that keeps us safer. Arguably, also, it is surrendering of a lot of our civil rights in the name of a crisis.
Fear allows you to do a lot of things, Eldon.
It does. It absolutely does. It is the motivator, if you will. And you know, when you look at how all these things tie together, again, you've got to come back and say, is there a point that as human beings, we're not going to turn off our brains and give over everything to the authority? Is there a point where we're not going to, in the name of consistency, just comply? You know, one of the real compliance principles is consistency. We have the need to be consistent. So let's just say we elect a leader and then we become disenchanted with what the leader does. Well, it's going to take a lot of disenchantment before we'll move away from that leader or begin to say, now, wait a minute, I don't like that, because we've already invested ourselves in them. Back in the lie detection days, and this is a great example, I think, when I used to give lie detection, whenever anybody gives a lie detection test, what you have to have is what we call pre-stress or control questions. So we have to be able to look at neutrals, you know, is your name George Nuri?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be able to look at pre-stress, where we know there's stress in the question, so that we can compare that to the relevant.
Yes.
And hopefully the relevant has less.
You know, it's like going into your doctor, your blood pressure's always up.
That's right.
And then he's got to get a basis for that before he knows if it's really up.
That's exactly right. But we want more than situational stress, because that's going to be across all the questions. So what I might do in a situation like that, George, is I might ask you, you know, have you ever lied to anyone that trusted? I mean, I know that you're an honest person. You've come here to tell me the truth today. So you don't look like a person that would lie to someone that trusted you. Did you lie to someone that trusted you? Now, most people are going to say no, because in order to be consistent with I'm here to take a lie detection test and here to prove that I'm honest, I have to say no.
Let's pick it up right from there when we come back. Plus, we will get into subliminal and reverse speech. By the way, our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, he does these things for me. 20 million died in the 1918 pandemic. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Eldon Taylor. When we come back, more on Mind Programming on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, we're talking about lie detector tests. And after we get through some of the things you're talking about, I want to ask you a question about a fellow by the name of Travis Walton. But go ahead.
Okay. What we were talking about actually was our need to comply. And one of the compliance principles is consistency. And how it's taken advantage of by, you know, anyone and everyone that knows about it. So, as I was explaining, you might come in for a lie detection test, and I would need a control question, and I would set up one of various scenarios to get the control question, but they would always work around what we call this principle of consistency. So I would ask you, you know, I mean, I'd set up the scenario by essentially saying, do you plan to be honest today? And of course, you'd say yes. And I'd say, well, all right, you look like an honest person. I assume you're here to tell me the truth. I mean, there'd be no other reason to come in here. So I'm on your team. I'm here to help prove your innocence. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions today. Among those questions, I'm going to ask you if you're an honest person, but I'm going to ask it this way. Did you ever lie to someone that trusted you? Because you don't strike me as somebody that had lied to someone that trusted you.
Okay, and if I lied, if I came in there intentionally to lie, why would I even come in? Because I have to assume the lie detector test is going to find out.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to ask myself that too, George, because I've got to tell you, lots of them come in, and they believe that they can beat the test. They believe they've read something about a countermeasure. They've got a thumbtack in their shoe. They're going to crimp down their sphincter muscle. They have their countermeasures all rehearsed out. Maybe they even, have done some self-hypnosis. But a good examiner will take all that away from them in a hurry. I can remember.
But it's not admissible in court, right?
Well, it depends. By stipulation, yes. But there, you know, a lie detection test is really an interrogation technique. That's what we have to understand. That's what they were developed for. They lead to confessions. You may stipulate that it's admissible. Sometimes law enforcement will tell you, well, if you pass the test, we may just send you home.
Right.
So there are lots of reasons to get you to take it, but what we're looking for is not the test saying you did or you didn't. What we're looking for is the amount of information that can be gained through that interrogation technique.
Which turns law enforcement loose to try to nail the guy, because then they may believe he's guilty.
Well, yeah, and you'd be surprised how many of them are guilty. You know, fact of the matter is, if you have a half a dozen people, let's say you have a burglary in a business from a business safe, and there's no outside entry that could have been made based on...
And eight people had keys, let's say.
Yeah. So what you're going to do is you're going to test all eight people. Now, one of these eight people took the money, and they're not going to say, oh, I'm not taking the test, because that's too self-incriminating.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to try and beat the test in the process. But my point wasn't so much about the test. It was about your need to comply. So out of compliance, you would likely say, no, I don't lie to anybody that trusted me. And even if you did say, well, yes, you know, I once I lied to my mother, or, you know, then I'm just going to change the question and say, okay, other than that one lie that you're telling me about, or other than these lies, you're not the kind of person that would lie to somebody who trusted you. What I'm looking to do out of consistency is get you to admit that, no, you're not going to lie to me, because, I mean, you're going to be consistent with that, and that creates a pre-stress. In research, we know this. If I can get you to put a decal in your front window, say a Greenpeace decal, and I come back a month later and ask you to put a small sign, like a real estate for sale sign, but the sign supports Greenpeace, you are 10 times more likely to put the sign in your yard once you put the decal in your window.
Interesting.
See?
Interesting.
So we just have these principles, these functions. I call them compliance principles. I spell them out. There are about 20 of them. 12 that work on us every day like this in everything that we decide.
Is it a lie if you're at a party and a woman comes up to you and says, hey, George, how do you like my dress? And it's the worst thing you've ever seen. And you say, God, you look great on this thing. It just looks great on you. It does. Now, that's a lie, right?
Yeah, that's a philosopher's conundrum. That's what that is. You know, look. I think the book says, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. When you look at lies, you know, if you're a lie detection examiner, I would say to you, George, you know, there's only 100% truth. There's no such thing as 99% truth. You either tell the truth or you don't. I mean, if you think about it, you want your wife to be 99% faithful?
No, no, I would exactly.
But if you look at it from a philosophical standpoint, you always have that question, you know. You arrive at the hospital, your mother and father have been in an automobile accident, heaven forbid. One of them is passed over. The physician says, whatever you do when you see your mother, don't tell her that your father is dead. It'll kill her. So, and the first thing out of your mother's mouth is, how's your dad? You know, it isn't as simple as that.
Good point.
So,
good point.
You know, it's a philosopher's conundrum. Travis, who?
Yeah, let me ask you this. Now, I don't know if you're familiar. Do you remember the movie and the book called Fire in the Sky at all? It's about a logger who, with his buddies, was out there on the West Coast, and he saw a beam of light. He got out of his truck, went running to it. His buddies are yelling at him, don't do it, don't do it. And he got hit by that beam of light. He collapsed. They thought he was dead. They panicked. They left him. He was gone for 3 days. He comes back with his incredible story that he was abducted by aliens and a UFO. He passes lie detector tests. They then give the other loggers, his buddies, this true story. They give them lie detector tests. What happened, you know, I mean, they didn't know that he got abducted, but they saw some of the things that happened.
Right.
They passed the test. Does this mean this is indeed a true story?
Well, what it means is this person truly believes it. You know, when you say that, I think this all happened back in the 70s somewhere in Arizona, didn't it?
I think it was more up near Washington. I'm going to get the exact
was
spot
it? Okay.
In a second.
But what it reminds me of, I'll just share this with you. There was a point in time that I had a dear friend come to me, and he said, you know, Eldon, do you know anything about channeling? I said, well, you know, I know a little bit about it. Why? And he says, well, I think I'm channeling. Now, this dear friend was a chair of a chemistry department at a major university, a Sorbonne fellow. His dream had been to win a Nobel Prize. So channeling, you know, well, it turns out, you know, he channels still to this day. He channels several entities, and these entities come into him. And
you're right. It was Arizona.
Okay. I got lucky. See,
you
had the
good.
1918, not the 1929.
Oh, yeah.
But anyhow.
Yeah, but I should have known that.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. Hey, anyhow, you know what? I have fun doing this with you, George Nuri. You are a great person to interview someone. Now, with that out of the way.
I'm going to strap you up to a polygraph. No, I'm kidding.
No, that's fine. You can do that. So, anyway, I thought about writing a book called Voices of the Gods, because at the same time I had this friend telling me he was channeling, and I was suspicious of that, I had a client in my investigation business. It was a major channel, all over television, all over everywhere, that calls me on the phone and says, I have an opportunity to make this business investment. These people are flying into LAX. I've got to meet them. I've got to deliver the money. And I have a peculiar feeling. And I, you know, I'd like you to check this out for me before I give them the money. And, you know, I can't ask this entity that I'm channeling, because that's just not kosher. You know, that's about money.
Right.
And that, you know, triggers some suspicion in me. Okay. So I thought, you know, what a good book could it be to just go around and give lie detection tests to all these channels. And just about then, we had the Lafferty boys in Utah have God speak to them. And so they killed their sister-in-law, according to the instructions of God. Now, because we were doing some work at the prison system, I knew people at the prison system, I can tell you this, that these two young men absolutely, totally, unequivocally believed God spoke to them and told them to do this.
Jeez.
So I never went with the book. I never ran the lie detection test, because it became clear to me that what we're looking at is what they truly believe. And if they truly believe that, then the lie detection test isn't going to do anything. And I'm going to come back and tell you again that, you know, a good lie detection test is an interrogation method. It isn't simply a question of were you abducted on this day? Were you gone for 3 days? There has to be all that other complement
right.
that would go with that.
And you see a pattern there then, don't you?
Yeah, and I'm sure that in this instance he didn't get that because he isn't a criminal suspect, so you're not really going to interrogate the man.
Yeah. Now, you know, we hired a polygraph examiner several months ago for one of our guests. The guy came on the air, and he talked about how he had a picture of an alien looking through a window, his daughter's bedroom window.
Uh-huh.
And you could see this very bizarre-looking figure. Now, to me, it looked like a cutout. But nonetheless, he claims that he saw it, and it ran away. Okay? And there was video of this thing. So it was kind of weird. Anyways, I asked him if he'd be willing to take a polygraph test. Mm-hmm. And he said yes. So we arranged it with a pretty good polygraph examiner out of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And the guest went and got wired up, and the results came back, and the polygraph examiner said, I don't think he's telling the truth about this story.
Deception
he
indicated.
Basically said he failed the test. He lied. He said he failed the test.
Now,
the guy came back, though, and said that he was on medication. The individual, I was on medication on this and that, so I'm sure it affected this, and I wasn't happy with the questions. Regardless, I'm not sure it really happened.
Well, you know, and the examiner makes a big difference, but if you have a DI chart or deception indicated chart, you have no reason to believe the person. I mean, first of all, what you have in a polygraph is just a sophisticated form of biofeedback. And if there's that kind of distress in relevant questions, there's something behind the distress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a properly, you know, structured test takes things like situational stress, drugs, da-da-da, into consideration. And you can be on lots of drugs, but again, you come back to a zone of comparison test with irrelevance and pre-stress and control and relevant questions. And in order for him to have a deceptive indicated test, he has to have stressed in those relevant questions what we call distress, which would be significantly greater physiological responses than what you would see in a control of pre-stress or, you know, even a forced lie or an irrelevant. But I'm reminded when you say that, John DeLorean, I was one of those people involved in DeLorean's lie detection test this way. I'm not going to name the examiner. I'll keep us both out of trouble here. But the examiner initially examined DeLorean and said, clean, clear to Flagtown. He's telling the truth. He doesn't know anything about these drugs. Okay? I saw the video of that. In the video, DeLorean is all over. He's taking very obvious countermeasures, and the examiner is ignoring them all. To the extent that we filed charges against that examiner.
Wow.
You can have an examiner, for whatever reason, maybe they're asleep at the wheel, maybe, you know.
Mesmerized by the person, right?
I'm not going to attempt to come up with what their motive is, but examiners can do a very poor job. And I remember a homicide case that I was called into. A young man was actually in prison for the brutal murder of his mother. And part of the reason he was imprisoned is because he'd been given a lie detection test. He'd failed the lie detection test. He was then told, look, you know, if you cop to this, we can make it easier on you and da-da-da. So he had pled guilty. Well, this wasn't the brightest young man on the planet, and he'd been doing alcohol and drugs that night, but he didn't kill his mother. But the test he took was a simple two-needle test. There were only, you know, two different measurements on. This was a homicide in a state that required a minimum of four different measurements to the polygraph. I ran my own lie detection test on him, and the kid passed it. I did forensic hypnosis on him, And he could tell me things that happened that night that we were able to verify that placed him elsewhere. One of the things is a case point. He had no conscious recollection without the hypnosis, but he told us under hypnosis how he'd been cutting through a park on his way home because he'd found his mother and reported the crime, called law enforcement. And he saw a police officer pull into the park. So he hid behind this bench and watched this police officer get out of his car, search the trash, call in, go back to the trash, get back in the car, and then leave. Well, it was easy enough for us to check the police logs and the timing that was involved to verify whether or not that happened, because that placed him in the park. And it placed him in the park at the time of the murder, and with the distance, et cetera, it was part of the it was part of the evidence that we used to reverse the decision and see that this young man was freed. So you can have bad examiners, you can have bad equipment, but if you have a deception-indicated test, again, you don't have reason to believe you. You may question it. You may ask him to take another test, but you have no reason to believe the person.
Absolutely. Did you do any work with reverse speech at all?
I did, indeed. You know, I stumbled onto that one. One of the instruments that I used to use was called, a psychological stress evaluator. And what it does is it looks for a muscle microtremor that accompanies all voluntary muscle movement. We would record all of our examinations, and the recording device or tool was a Uhair recorder, a reel-to-reel recorder like you used to see on television when you saw spy movies. And we would record at 15, 16 inches per second. Because it was recorded that way, I could, you know, back it up just with my finger, back up a simple answer, and in one little quarter turn, get somebody's answer. The first time I encountered this, I had a lie detection examination with a deceptive indicated chart. It was a simple crime. I think it was a theft. And the relevant question, did you take the missing money? When I reversed his no, it said liar.
My gosh.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was so, whoa. I had to get everybody to listen to it because I just reversed it with my finger.
You couldn't believe it?
Liar. Now, he later gave us a confession, and we had a recovery. So I know the liar is good, but at the time I encountered it, I thought, boy, isn't that ever a strange coincidence.
Why can't you hear that with the human ear at that time before it's reversed?
Well, I had a station out of Ohio, in the early 90s, KCNI, I believe is what it was. I could check that. But it was a station out of Ohio contact me and say, Madonna's new release has some backmasked, reversed subliminal messages in it. And could you verify that for us? And so I had him send me in the soundtrack. We reversed the soundtrack, and sure enough, it had satanic lyrics.
Amazing. Let's talk more about that and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.